We left off last time characterizing or trying to characterize those radicals who were opposing Oliver Cromwell in the so-called army debates about the future of England once the army had won the civil war against the king. And I talked about the levelers, whom you might call in many ways, I suppose, the moderates, fundamental constitution, freedom of conscience, and universal suffrage. Cromwell opposed these people largely on the universal suffrage issue. And the kind of issue he put up to counter universal suffrage was the issue that only those should have a vote who had a stake in England, by which he meant only those should have a vote who held land. This would, of course, made nonsense of universal suffrage and instead left things very much as they were. But there were others who were, in a sense, more radical than the levelers. Though you must never make the lines too tight at this point. People passed back and forth among a lot of groups. But the strength of the levelers was that they controlled some army regiments, which is more than the other radicals did, to whom I must now come. There were those who were millenarians, the so-called Fifth Monarchy men, who thought that the thousand-year Reich was about to commence. These people, who were not really a group, but a scattering in a way, refused to obey any mortal commands, thinking themselves filled of the Holy Spirit. They revived the idea of prophecy, and I don't think we have to dwell much longer on them, except to make clear that here once more this kind of millenarianism burst forth onto the scene. More important were what we might call the communitarians, or as they would have been called, utopian communists. This is a value judgment already, under Gerald Winstanley's leadership. The importance of these people is not so much that they were a powerful group, which they never were, but the importance is that they put forward certain ideas which were going to have an important history. Gerald Winstanley believed that the idea of equality is of Christian origins and that private property should be abolished. Nothing very new there. You have that kind of movement throughout the Middle Ages. It has a long tradition. Remember that already Thomas More, in his Utopia, abolished private property as well. However, Gerald Winstanley did not stop at this point. What is important about him, above all important about him, that in the midst of this long Christian tradition of the abolishing of private property and of equality, he made a straight linkage between political liberty and economic equality. His group is miscalled the Utopian Socialists, for Gerald Winstanley introduced into his ideas of equality a great deal of rationalism. Reason, he tells us, must be embodied in the institutions of this world. But reason means that we can only properly function if we are equal, if there is no private property which divides us, if there is, as he said, a common freedom. If Christianity means equality, then it stands to reason that the abolishment of private property must be a part of this equality. Therefore, you cannot really have true Christian freedom, true Christian equality, without the abolishment of private property. What Gerald Winstanley does in this way, he links political freedom, any kind of freedom, and economic equality. This is important, for he will be followed by others who do the same. Above all, a man by the name of Harrington, who wrote a book that you might as well know about, called The Oceana, did this really in the first place theoretically. Harrington goes on to say that without economic equality, there can be no political liberty. This is the kind of straight linkage, which is one heritage of the revolution, neither of them important groups, but making points which come from the revolutionary situation, points which will obviously have a long history. If we have the levelers, the Fifth Monarchy men, these men who were called popularly the diggers. They were called diggers because Winstanley tried to make this fact by simply taking over some land belonging to other people and digging on it, that is to say, planting it, a squatting, as we would say. Well, that is an unfair name. They're more important than that because Cromwell chased them off with a very few soldiers and it collapsed. But they are still called the diggers. Their ideas are important as a political group at the time. They have very little importance. The third idea is more complex, which comes out of the situation. That third idea I must put to you this way, that if man is bad, as we are constantly told, as man is full of original sin, if so many people are oppressed, then what can God have to do with this world? God is good. God wouldn't allow people to be oppressed. God wouldn't allow people to be so sinful and bad that you have to fight them. Therefore, it follows that God doesn't care. For if he cared, then evil would be a part of God's universe. And how can you link evil to God? That means that we are wholly mortal, that God has withdrawn from this world. He doesn't care. He has withdrawn. We are wholly mortal. We will become immortal only at the resurrection. These people are called the soul sleepers. They are called the soul sleepers because they believe that your soul is mortal until the resurrection. And they believe it for reasons that I hope I have made clear. Two things about them. First of all, these soul sleepers are the most constant popular heritage in the early modern period. Calvin wrote his first tract against them. They crop up again in the English Revolution. Most heresy trials between there are actually directed against them. They will crop up in colonial America. This is the great lower class heritage, heresy, what we call soul sleeping. Now, why is it so important? Because here is the beginning of two other things. Here and here only is the beginning of modern materialism. This is the beginning of modern materialism. Not Hobbes, this goes far beyond Hobbes, but a popular heresy which comes to us from the Middle Ages, which is simply, in a sense, a logical kind of thing. For how indeed could God be the father of evil? A logical kind of thing, but which tends to transform man into a purely mortal, or as we would say, materialistic creature. It is also the beginning of an anti-Christian movement, and therefore has very many links with the Enlightenment of the 18th century. For if God is withdrawn upon his clouds, then of course Christianity is a sham. Salvation is a sham. It is another means of suppression. For God is gone until the resurrection from his evil world, leaving evil and oppression free reign. Therefore, if people talk about Christianity now, they are talking, in effect, about oppression. So that this becomes an anti-Christian movement. There's only one exception. As this is a popular movement, there's also some millenarianism in it. And therefore, there is here also a prophet. And the prophet has a link with God. He prophesies the future. There will be a bright future after the resurrection. The prophet knows it. The prophet knows it. But in reality, you and I are purely mortal creatures. This is what the age called libertinism, because it led also to a loosening of manners and morals. Because if you are purely mortal until the resurrection, why should you not follow your own nature? What is the guide? God can't be the guide. He has withdrawn. Christ is meaningless. What guide do you have? Only your own nature. Therefore, you follow your own nature. And you know what that means. So that this did become a libertinism, above all in France, above all at the court of Louis XIII, 14th, but also to a certain extent even at the court of Charles I, a kind of libertinism. But more important, in the Revolution, it pierced through again from a lower class movement and became, if you like, the beginning of a modern materialism. And that, I think, is not on the whole unimportant to remember. Now, all of this kind of radicalism that I have talked about now was, of course, aborted. Cromwell, to be sure, suppressed it, persecuted it. But Cromwell was uneasy about it. He still believed that the radicals, even the Fifth Monarchy men, might have something. Cromwell was deeply pious. So he decided to make another experiment. And instead of the army debates, he asked each religious grouping, regardless whether they were Fifth Monarchy men or close to the diggers or the levelers, each religious grouping to send a delegate to a parliament. And he got a parliament going, composed out of the leaders of the religious sects. This parliament goes under the name of Bare Bones Parliament. And the reason it goes under the name of Bare Bones Parliament is very simple. It was dominated by a man called God Bless Bare Bones. Well, he was really called Bare Bones. What happened was obvious, isn't it? You got all the prophets together. You were going to have a lot of prophecy, but very little action. So that Praise God Bare Bones, who dominated this, was in fact a prophet, or thought of himself a prophet, in the way that I have just talked with soul sleeping. The greatest soul sleeping prophet was a man called Muggleton, but he was not at Bare Bones Parliament. It was God Praise Bare Bones who was there. Now, this was obviously a failure, because you didn't only get levelers who would have made sense out of the business, but you also got Fifth Monarchy men, you got diggers, you got soul sleepers, you got all sorts of people, and obviously the matter collapsed. It was Cromwell's last attempt to do it that way, to really make a republic of saints. Instead, as you know, his rule became based upon a rule by force. There was for him, it seemed, from his point of view, at any rate, no alternative. He was not able to accept the levelers, and if he wasn't able to do that, which was the only feasible program, really, an alternate program, there was really nothing left for him in the end but the rule of force. And yet, there was, even in the rule of force, in Cromwell's own rule, single rule, a remarkable amount of toleration. A little group of Fifth Monarchy men met constantly in a corner of St. Paul's Cathedral. Exeter Cathedral was divided by a brick wall, Presbyterian on the one side, a sort of independent on the other side of the wall. As I said, the only ones who were not tolerated were atheists, Catholics, and Anglicans. And the idea of atheists was so large that really it never became anything very pinpointed, at least at first. Now, as we know, and I won't really bother with that at the moment, Cromwell's rule did not last. His son could not very well continue. In the end, the army intervened again. The army, above all, the army that was stationed in Scotland, afraid of the radicals now. Because with Cromwell's son, there was a kind of outburst, not of leveler radicalism, but of millenarianism, above all. Afraid of this kind of radicalism, the army acted, and the army restored Charles II in 1660. Now, this restoration of Charles II didn't mean all was lost. He returned, remember, not as a divine monarch, but he returned as the creature of Parliament, which was also restored. It was believed that the king would no longer be able to do without Parliament, for the king was now a pensioner of Parliament. That is to say, all his own income was gone, abrogated, and he was dependent on parliamentary appropriation. The reason that didn't work in Charles II's case is that he took bribes from Louis XIV of France, that Louis XIV of France paid him to be neutral, and therefore he did have a way, an income, with which Parliament had not, after all, reckoned. Still, however that might be, not only the king and Parliament was restored, but also the Anglican Church. There was to be no longer any toleration. And you are now on the road to the formation of what we might call the unwritten English Constitution. Two more processes were necessary, which I can only sketch very briefly. First of all, another revolution in 1688. For James II again looked to Louis XIV. James II again took money from Louis XIV. James II believed that if he had money, he could have a mercenary army. So he imported Irish for a mercenary army in England. James II was probably a Catholic and therefore tried to abrogate all leniency in matters of faith, for he believed he had to settle England on a Catholic basis with a mercenary army and do all these things that France had done but England had never managed to do. As you know from your reading, the revolution of 1688 was quick, unbloody, and successful. The Bill of Rights, which you will read in your source book, incorporated the results. The results wished for in 1660. But even with the Bill of Rights, which is a product of the Restoration, with the Revolution of 1688, a second step was necessary, and that to transform England into its modern guise. And that was slow. The transfer of the executive power from the king to Parliament. That was very slow. For there was no question after 60 that while the king was dependent on money, for money on Parliament, it was he who was the executive. It is he who governed. That was never questioned. It wasn't questioned for James II. It wasn't questioned for William and Mary. It wasn't questioned for Queen Anne even, the last of the Stuarts, who still had a great deal of magic. She was the last English monarch to cure for the king's sickness, or touch for the king's sickness. She still had a great deal of magic. That transfer of power takes practically a century to accomplish. And all I want to say here is that in the 18th century, because of the new English dynasty being German, not really caring, the Hanoverian dynasty, not really caring much for England, not even speaking English very much, the executive power gradually slipped to where the money was, that is, to Parliament. It is a gradual progress. And gradually, and it wasn't even finished till the 19th century, the king's minister was responsible to Parliament rather than to the king. That doesn't really come about till the 19th century almost, you might say. It is a very gradual transfer, very gradual, more a slipping into it, that the minister is responsible to where the power of the purse is, rather than to the king himself. To the end of the 18th century, English monarchs still appointed ministers without consulting Parliament, or without caring for what Parliament thought of it. So only very gradually that the king loses his executive power. He will not lose it completely almost until the 20th century. As you know, perhaps from other causes, Queen Victoria still interfered, and interfered all the time. Even King George V in the 20th century still interfered and interfered all the time. Therefore, only gradually does the English king reign but not rule. That comes about only very gradually, more than a century after 1688. The Restoration then meant that England was on the road to becoming a parliamentary monarchy with the real power in Parliament. But as I said, that took more than another 100 years to accomplish. Not a Parliament based on universal suffrage, but a Parliament unrepresentative only of the gentry who controlled the seats. There was only free election in one constituency, only in the constituency of Westminster, that is central London at the time, only in the constituency of Westminster was there what we would call a popular election. All the other seats of Parliament were controlled by individuals, and were even bought and sold publicly. You could open a paper in the 18th century and find a borough for sale, a seat for sale. This was a parliament, therefore, that had never been, and now was no more, a representative. Universal manhood suffrage will have to wait, and wait again, over a century. That we must not forget. Was therefore the revolution a failure? Well, it depends how you define failure. No event is a failure because every event is a part of history. So by definition, there is no such thing as a clear failure or a clear success. It's quite true that the revolution went back to its start. That the people who really won the revolution in a meaningful sense are those parliamentary leaders who started it in 1640, who wanted a Presbyterian constitutional monarchy. Now, they didn't get their Presbyterianism, but they did get the kind of constitutional monarchy. They did get the kind of laws which seemed to make for order. They did get that kind of thing. They certainly succeeded, at least for a moment, of doing away with radicalism, whether level or otherwise, that had dominated the revolution. Let us list for a minute the things that came out of it, so that it is clear in your mind. First of all, success and failure apart in the immediate context, democratic ideas were for the first time explicitly stated and explicitly stated as the program of a political party. I refer here to the levelers above all. For the first time, we have a growing realization of the intimate connection of economics and politics, above all in Winstanley and his Diggers, then in Harrington's Oceana, that liberty must have economic and social foundations. I mean explicit. I mean that this comes first. I mean that this is rationally determined. Secondly, what about Puritanism? Puritanism was not tolerated after 1660. All sects were forbidden. Yet, this did not last. After 1700, there were those who dissented from the Church of England. They called themselves dissenters. To be sure, jobs were closed to them and universities. And indeed, until the 19th century, universities and any government job, if you like, were closed to people who were not members of the Church of England. That is to say, to dissenters and to Catholics. The dissenters are the inheritors of the Puritans. They were Presbyterians. They were Congregationalists, Independents. They were all this. But what happened to Puritanism as it became dissent is that it lost its aggressiveness. What had been Puritan sects now became respectable. This goes for the Baptists, another foundation, of course, of revolutionary radicalism originally. For the Baptists, that goes for the Congregationalists, another radical revolutionary foundation. They now become respectable. Indeed, we can say what sects lasted from the Revolution. What was a prerequisite that Puritan sect lasted? The prerequisite was that somehow it became respectable. Let me give you an example. The most radical of all sects, in many ways, was called Quakers or Society of Friends, because they baptized the biblical way. If you baptize, you quake as the Spirit of the Holy Lord, the Holy Spirit comes into you. They were radicals. George Fox, their founder, believed himself to be a seeker, violent in their spiritual burnings, as violent in many ways as any Fifth Monarchy man. But two things enabled them to survive. First of all, their millenarian excesses were tempered by emphasis upon the Bible, upon sin, upon a plain and sober life. And secondly, they could attract upper-class people. The most famous upper-class person they attracted early is William Penn. Thirdly, I should say, they had no program other than a kind of piety, Bible. They had no sect radical goal. Thus, they survived. They survived. From a Puritan sect, they became dissenters. From poor dissenters, they became rich dissenters. And they survived, and survived very well. Inasmuch as Puritanism became dissent, the dissenters became an important element of the population. And through their emphasis, their Puritan emphasis, in a sense, on inner piety, on the war between the spirit and the flesh, upon discipline, upon plain and sober living. These dissenters injected, of course, into England a way of life that will be of the greatest importance. I dare say it wouldn't have amounted to much if there had not been a tremendous religious revival in England in the 18th century. If that religious revival hadn't fastened on to dissent and to the Puritan tradition. But the dissenters who were not persecuted after 1770, just jobs were closed, and that they went into commerce, therefore, became leading commercial bankers, merchants, the dissenters, and then in the 18th century, the Methodist revival, the evangelical revival, beginning of Methodism, this tremendous revival, these things together did change the English attitudes and, in a sense, the English way of life, and changed it very sharply indeed. That and the opposition to the French Revolution will come in as well. Puritanism, therefore, did not die out. It went into an attitude of life, which it was, as a matter of fact, in the first place. It was never clearly theologically defined. An attitude of life which will, together with the later Methodist revival, remember John Wesley, work, pray, and save. Remember John Wesley's great theme, work, pray, and save. Introduce into the English character what we now call the kind of Victorian morality and attitudes. And these attitudes again, work, pray, and save, the battle between the flesh and the spirit, the discipline, the mental discipline, that very greatly contributed to making England the first industrialized nation of Europe. For it is the dissenter attitudes, the attitudes then in the evangelical revival, which are almost a prerequisite for the building of an industrial society. So that these things do go hand in hand, that here the revolution didn't just peter out, but in this way even laid the foundations for the founding of industrial England, the first industrial nation, after all, of modern times. The results of the English Revolution, therefore, must not be made too simple. An attitude of life, ideas, a restoration which was not a looking backward, but a restoration which looked in a sense to the future, however unrepresentative a parliament was. A restoration which would, through the Bill of Rights, in the end protect some basic human rights. In this way, the levellers had not lived in vain. The Bill of Rights will protect some essential rights, above all the right of habeas corpus, but also some other essential rights, as you will see. In that way, the levellers and their fundamental constitution had not lived in vain. And, of course, finally, it was good, in retrospect, that the power in England did not go into the hands of the common man, but instead into the hands of the merchant and gentry classes. For again, it are these classes which will start the industrial revolution in England. Why? Because, as the last extract in your source book says, and read it carefully, it were the Whigs which had triumphed, and the Whigs were devoted not only to a certain parliamentary freedom, but also to economic freedom, in the sense of laissez-faire, in the sense of let alone, in the sense of founding their own bank, the Bank of England. So that, which I will talk about later, so that, in a sense, as one final result of the revolution, the English economy got into the hands of the merchant and bankers and the gentry, not into the hands of the king, not into the hands of the state, not into the hands of the smallholders. And if you take this together with the idea of the new attitudes of these dissenters, you will see why the early factories, while the pioneering in the factory and industrial system in the next century was done so largely by dissenters, was done so largely by dissenting families, the same families which had helped found the Bank of England, the same families which now had control of the economy, and which meant, in effect, that England's Industrial Revolution was to come before, or more rapidly, than the Industrial Revolution in the rest of Europe, much more rapidly. But that is another result of the English Revolution, is the Industrial Revolution in England. These two things go together because of what classes triumphed, the way they triumphed, and the attitudes that they brought with their triumph. Now, all of this is in your last extract in the source book. And this is as good a place as any to stop for a minute in the chronological way that we have been roughly proceeding, though you must remember that this is all now in England at the same time as Louis XIV, and it does play to it, to stop for a minute and to consider the economic picture, not only England, but in the continent, to consider the economic system which grew up in the 17th century and which has been given the name of mercantilism. But again, this mercantilism, this economic system, is again connected with what Neff, in your reading, calls the first industrial revolution. The first industrial revolution. And so what we must really pause to see next time is to see the first industrial revolution, not only in England, but also in France, which was greatly accelerated, perhaps I can best put it this way, greatly accelerated and made into the great industrial revolution in England, England first, by the events we have considered. But these are, of course, not the only things that go into the Industrial Revolution, and the Industrial Revolution is not the only thing that comes out of the English Revolution.